the house, but like his side plane.
His side piece.
That he records him too. Hi, Kevin. Hi, Andy. How are you?
Hello, folks.
Hello.
We're talking shit about Kevin.
What?
Not just
Go
Kevin.
Go for it.
Everybody.
Bring it on. Yeah.
Julian, what are you talking shit about today?
I mean,
Riverside's no hand feature.
Riverside's no hand feature, or the fact that Opal doesn't work with everything, even though I quite like it. Because Kevin seduces me every week by saying, oh, you look so good with this camera. I'm like, oh, let me try again every week.
You do. It looks a lot better.
There's a lot of stuff that's going on in the world at the moment. This company that we were talking about last week that Bill Gurley is on the board of, Good Egg, is that the name of the company?
Good Eggs.
Yeah, Good Eggs, which, and a bunch of other companies are doing these cram down rounds. One of them recently I saw that wiped out Sequoia, I forget, the separate company. So it's like, it's this wild world that's happening right now. And like a growth fund was just raised around down rounds specifically. It's something that I happen to see on Axios or something last week. And so it's wild out there. SVB was bought by, is it called First Republic? Sorry, I'm Canadian.
I think it's First Citizen.
First Citizen,
right? Yeah. Like a bank from North Carolina. And so how do you feel? Do you feel like your stuff that you're doing is risky, or do you feel the same, or do you feel better for some reason than you did before? Kevin?
So it depends on what side of me. So I feel great because our customers love our product and mm-hmm. we're growing like weeds.
Yeah.
I don't feel great on the investor sentiment and the overall sentiment in like the American economy. I'm no economist, so I'm not going to take any like personal viewpoints on that, but just the sentiment is not great. But I could also see like in the next 3 to 6 months, everything turning around and this thing start ripping again. The market start ripping again. And just based on, a few different factors, doesn't look like the banks are going to collapse, even though that SVB definitely, as far as like the VC industry, it like put it on pause for at least 6 months. Like everybody is like,
for sure,
holding out, and that is going to destroy companies. And that, if it will give you a recap, and maybe Andy can explain what actually physically happened, because he was in finance before. But do you want to explain just the mechanics of what is SVB, what happened to them? You don't have to take a personal viewpoint on them.
So for anyone listening out there, what happened? It's an old-fashioned bank run. What's a bank run? It used to be everyone would go to the local bank branch, this picture 1930s pictures, and you'd go ask for your money back, and people would fight themselves in line to get their cash back. And once the bank was out of cash, the bank would have to close. Today, how does a bank run work? Well, it's done on apps. It's done on your mobile app. You can wire out from your account. And a bank run can drain a well-capitalized bank in, I don't know, 8 to 12 hours, give or take, because of the
$44 billion out of SVB or something?
I'm not sure the exact numbers, but it's a mobile bank run. So you can get your money out via the internet on a mobile device wherever you are in the world.
So why did this happen? It was from an underlying bad investment that SVB made.
Yeah, SVB owned a bunch of mortgage securities, and what they basically had is a mismatch in duration. So they own mortgages, mortgage-backed security, and treasury bills that would be fine if they held them to maturity. But on an interim basis, when interest rates went up, the price of these bonds
right.
and mortgages went down. And so what you'd have to do is, if you want to meet redemptions, you have to sell these bonds and mortgages at a loss. And according to the news that I've read, that's what they had to do. And so once you take a loss for a bank business, you deplete your book value, your shareholders' equity. and you have to then go raise equity capital. And my takeaway from this is they actually didn't have a bad balance sheet. This is nothing like Lehman Brothers or any of the stories that we heard from 2008. This was just a confluence of bad events. So one, they needed to raise capital. My guess is they were probably slow on raising capital. Two, Twitter is a vicious cycle, and you saw a rumor mill on Twitter. And three, everyone has a mobile app now. And so this didn't exist in 2008. Back then, you couldn't just wire your money out that quickly. And so now you can drain a capital, you can drain a bank very quickly. And we saw this with a few other banks, it looks like. It wasn't just SVB. It was Signature Bank in the U.S., which is a New York-based primary real estate lending bank. And First Republic got into a bunch of trouble on their own. All these banks have one thing in common. They all cater to businesses or wealthy individuals. So it's much better to have a deposit base of people all over the U.S. who have $10,000 in their account. It's much harder to drain that. But when you have businesses with $20, $30, $40, $50 million in your account, you can drain a bank very quickly. And that's what happened. And that's why the primary, the banks that have succumbed to this are mostly business focused or high net worth focused.
It's kind of wild when you think about it. I just did the math for, I guess, the first time in my head. $50 million in an account, which, by the way, I want to emphasize is a lot, but in venture is not as much as it would be out there in the rest of the world. 20 of those businesses, boom, $1 billion, bam, right away. And if you've been in venture for a while, you know that it is possible. Not easy, but possible.
Definitely not smart to have 50 million. Regardless, if you have $50 million, you should have a CFO and you should be spreading that across even before this happened. But regardless, I think what we should talk about is some of the ramifications now. So SVB has been purchased. Who knows? Like, I think that SVB, and I've been publicly a big proponent of SVB. I've been with them for the past 10 years. I bank with them both with us now and my previous business and personally as well. And I've been a big proponent. I think that what they offered startups was something very unique. They offered them a lot of the different services that some of the other big banks didn't. And they also catered to VCs. And so this is the reason why I think it's really healthy to have a lot of different competition in like the banking world. Like if we just had the big four, they wouldn't offer different services that catered to certain different demographics or different businesses. So I think that's why I really did like SVB. But what's happened now and the fallout is that everybody is the VC industry as well. I'd say most find it like most invest. I don't know. I'll just talk about the VC industry because I know more about that than any other investment industries. But it's very, you get very skittish and it could go one way or another very quickly. So it could go very bullish as we've seen in 2021 when interest rates are super low and you can see these high markups in public companies, then everybody's investing in everything. And then when the potential of bank collapses are going to happen and they're going to worry about, well, if I make this investment in this Series A company, who's going to lead the Series B? Should I even be making Series A investments? Also, should I be making Series B investments, even if it is a really good company? And so what that does is just, and what I'm obviously hoping for everybody is that it's just going to put a pause, but it definitely, I would say, is put a massive pause for even good companies going out to raise money. Just from the fallout, even though the SVB is back in business, nobody lost any money, but the sentiment out there is still like very conservative and very like fearful versus being very optimistic.
You know, when you used to have teammates, you know, you would. I remember my last company, and also at the very beginning of this one, I'm sure Kevin, you felt the same thing, where people are like, I don't know if you expressed to people, we have this much runway, but I have kind of like always talked about it. And I've said, okay, we were going to go out at this date to raise the next thing or whatever.
Yep.
And, but definitely like just today I was having a one-on-one with one of my teammates, and it was like, are we going to draw down this debt? Should we do that? Because a practice has a debt line that they got with Silicon Valley Bank Canada, right? Which is an entity that's like vaguely associated, but not completely commensurate with SVB US. And so one of the things that people are asking themselves is will the new owner of Silicon Valley Bank, will they have a relationship with venture capital that is like, oh yeah, like we'll take care of you if you, for example, if you don't hit your numbers in 12 months from now on, then how forgiving would SVB be? Traditionally, they would be quite forgiving, right? And most venture lenders would be quite forgiving. They would say it would be, oh, no big deal. Like we can figure something out. There was this relationship with SVB, and in New York, it was, I think, with Square One and some others. They were always really chill about it. And now the question is will this new acquirer do the same? And so it's making people like me question whether I should draw down, because I'm thinking, what about this new owner, right? Is this new owner trustworthy the way, and will they have a relationship with, for example, Andreessen Horowitz, the way that SVB has a relationship with Andreessen Horowitz, for example?
Yeah, I think it's hard to say. And I think that if you, so it's been common practice for a lot of VCs and also founders, as soon as you raise a round, you get you go to SVB, you're banking with SVB, you'll get a loan, a venture debt loan. It could be up to half of what you raise in equity sometimes, and that was just what you did. And it's always on the promise of that you're going to get your next deal, because how SVB and how most banks make their money is they make money off of the interest they make in their balance sheet. So SVB wants you to keep, they want everybody, including the VCs and the founders, they all want to keep this ecosystem alive. That's how everybody makes money. Banks make money by having balance or by having capital inside SVB. They make money on the interest. VCs make money on the exits. Entrepreneurs make money on the exits. So it's this huge community that works together very well. I don't know what's going to happen with this new bank, if they're going to be as, they're going to work as closely with the startups and VCs. There may be some changes in that. And I think that, like, I've seen a lot of advice going around, and I don't know if this is like actually true, but a lot of people are like, I always tell my portfolio companies, never take any debt, because debt can be really like, it can kill a company. But if you're already taking venture, that means you're already not profitable. And you always need that next round anyways. Mm-hmm. So does a little extra debt, does it really, I think that's the other side of the coin. Does it really make a big difference? It may give you some extra runway. But debt, you have to actually pay back. And if you don't pay it back, the bank can own your actual startup. So I think it definitely catch 22. I'd say if you're profitable and you don't need to take debt, then you definitely should not.
Yeah.
But the nature of running a venture backed business is that we're not profitable.
It's almost like a new type of risk that
it is.
Because back in the day, like in 2015, and Andy, I'm super curious about like what happened with iBankers. I'm going to ask you this in a second. Like, what happened with iBankers during Lehman Brothers and in 2008 and other things like this? Like, was there a kind of a systemic pullback in the same way? But just say that debt at the time, Breather had gigantic amounts of venture debt that it used on a rotating basis to pay for real expenses, right? Because it had real costs, cost of goods sold. And so that was used a great deal, but most software businesses don't really need it. And there was this view of, oh, don't put it on the books, the next investor won't like it. Having had the conversation today already with Andreessen Horowitz and some other people, I would say that each situation is, of course, unique, but that Andreessen is like, if you could draw it, you know, they're like, do it. And the perspective is that many companies will have debt on the books in the future in the next financing. So actually, like, all companies will be equal from that perspective. Now, Andy, Talk to me about like systemically what happened during, I mean, the big conversation, but, and you just express how they're different, but what happened after Lehman Brothers? Did iBankers like, did that really, those relationships break down? What happened exactly?
Investment banking is a little bit different than what we're talking about here. So investment banking is mainly mergers and acquisitions. So company wants to be bought or sold. Financings, but most likely IPOs, and very large credit. Not, you wouldn't deal with small, non-profitable venture-backed companies. You dealt with companies that were very large and generated a lot of EBITDA and free cash flow. In general, anytime you have some type of banking crisis, anytime you have some type of recession or shock to the system, credit becomes much harder to get. That's a rule. It doesn't matter if you're a semiconductor company, investment grade credit versus junk bonds versus venture backed companies. But in general, venture backed companies are the riskiest of risky companies. There is no cash flow. And it's been a very specific product that has mainly been historically sold by the banks in Silicon Valley plus debt funds. And those are the folks like WTI, Triple Point, some of the hedge funds, et cetera. And so in general, if you have a banking crisis, availability of credit is going to go down. The interesting part about this cycle and what happens is, how does this actually impact what the Fed is doing, i.e. raising interest rates? Because if you have a banking crisis, if you have loss in consumer confidence, potentially you actually do have inflation going down. And so this could be good for the economy. So it's very interesting to think through the first and even second order consequences of what will happen here. And I don't have a great answer.
I'm curious is whether this is something that you would feel, it's almost as if you have a business that in the quote unquote good times, you might have venture debt. It would be at like 3% interest or whatever, prime plus one, but that would be like a 4% interest rate or something like that. And it's actually much more affordable to draw down. But the result of the equity markets being so open and available and so easy to finance the company through the next round results in less debt being drawn down. Whereas ironically, here on the opposite side, the equity pulls back, and the result is that, and the debt is actually more onerous to have on the drawn down. So actually both sides are more difficult.
Right.
I mean, it's a big question, but it's like, how is an entrepreneur supposed to stay alive here? Other than making their costs as small as they possibly can, you know, it's,
they're big existential questions. Make your revenue higher than your costs.
Yeah.
Problem solved. But that's the opposite of what venture-backed companies have done, right? And so that's why it's a whole ecosystem and everybody needs to play, right? Like the banks need to play, that we need to have, obviously the entrepreneurs are always going to be here building stuff. The VCs need to play. And so right now you see a lot of crazy behaviors. Like I posted a tweet, and I got a lot of activity on it, and I'm seeing like friends of mine that are just starting out companies that are raising at like seed companies with like no deck at like 60 million post.
Right.
For seed. Because what's happening is that a lot of the later stage firms, they don't want to touch the B's and C's because they don't know when that next round is going to come from. And they may actually, they may even just look at, and those actually, maybe even a lot of the companies that raise at too high valuations still happen to have product market fit, everything like that. And also, given the SVB pause, they may just be, or the SVB situation, they might just be thinking, let's pause now, see what happens in the economy, because those are companies closer to going public. So you have a lot of larger firms coming into the seed where it's like, we don't need to see a lot of traction like for the next few years. And that I think also is not good behavior. Like I can't think of one company that's raised at like a 60 million post up for their seed that actually has done well.
It's actually wild. Like, belief is such an incredible thing. We, like, all of us here on this panel, we thrive off of belief, and we die when belief stops. And so the better you are at providing belief, and of course, belief occurs on a systemic basis as well. It is either high at any given time, like you get the benefit of the doubt at any funding conversation, for example, that you have, or employee conversation or anything, or it's at lows. And when it's at lows, it's like maybe someone, it would be harder to get them to join the business because they believe, you know, it's riskier to do so. Same day with a, with an investor, same with everything. So it's, and the draw, the biggest pullback, and I think, Kevin, you know this, is at your stage, the Series B stage.
Yeah.
In almost all cases, I think Thomas Tungas or whatever from Redpoint talked about how the number of dollars going into companies is equal, but the actual number of deals is gone down by something like 25 or 30 or some number percent, whereas they've only gone down 10 or 20 at the seed or at the A.
Right.
So you're actually the most affected. And beyond you, there's a breakout trajectory, which you might argue, of course, that you were already on. Right. But beyond you, there's a breakout trajectory and the winners are already chosen. So it's like it's financeable again.
Right. Yeah. It's and then you also have kind of the Walking Dead companies that are just not financeable as well. And that's where you may see, I don't know if we want to bring up the cram down rounds or something like that, kind of applicable too. So you either have the companies that raise at like 1 to 200x the revenue that are just like, they're probably not running on capital because they have a ton of capital, but it's like, do you give back money? Like, are you like, you don't have product market fit. You raise it way too much, big of a valuation. Yeah. What are you going to do? You're just walking dead.
I mean, it's a great question. So regarding the cram down rounds, I think Andy knows about them and I know about them because I've been part of them. And so what will happen, because the other thing that's happening is that these companies have gigantic pref stacks, okay?
Yes.
And so a company like yours that is, I think, quite honorably raised conservatively at every financing, you've been on the record saying that you want 18 months of funding each time you do it, and actually no more, for example. And I know you try to keep your burn as low as possible. Your company's profitable, I think, at this point. So
not profitable, no.
But close to profitable?
Cash flow
positive. Excuse me, that's what I meant.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then you keep your pref stack small, but then you had companies in the WeWork, Uber days, and even right up to 2022, like Web3 companies, all of a sudden that have a $50 million pref stack with no product market.
Right.
So what do investors do? And Andy has, my understanding is he's familiar with these. He's never been in a company that has done them. I have been on the board of a company that has done one. And so I've actually seen what happens when this occurs. And it's, someone wants to finance the company and they're interested in it, but they no longer believe A, that the pref stack is going to be paid back, or B, they're just like, the valuation is just not, is too high, or both.
Right.
And so they do one of these cram down rounds that Good Eggs did or some other, and that are increasingly going to become more common and talked about in the next couple of years versus before, where it was like kind of not discussed. Right. And so the pref stack essentially goes to as close to zero as possible by producing a pay to play mechanism where your equity is wiped out or converted if you do not participate in the round, and all of a sudden a bunch of investors go, oh shit.
Yep.
Andy, where have you seen this necessarily, unless you want to talk about it, but like, talk to me about like what you have noticed during financing like this when you were in venture.
So I'll caveat, I've never been on the side of receiving one of these. But when I was an associate in venture in 2009 to 2011, I did some of these. I worked at a firm that chose to really save companies versus just writing them off. And I have seen these done a few times. It typically involves restructuring the entire company. There is a lot of work involved for the VC. They have to want to roll up their hands and get dirty. It's typically a scenario where one VC has a lot of capital invested. And most of the time, it's more of a scenario where the VC acts like an operator versus a financial investor. Because this is a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And most of the time, if not done well, it's good money after bad. Where I've seen it work very well
is
people have a lot of capital in deals, say $30, $40 million in an earlier stage company. The company is performing well. They are just struggling to fundraise. They have some funds on the cap table that don't want to participate, and so on and so forth. And it's a very difficult conversation with the team. And I've seen successful companies go through this and then successfully exit. But it's work to get this to do this.
And everybody is unhappy when it happens.
It depends. I don't think everyone's unhappy when it happens. I think typically management teams will be incentivized to participate. I think smaller investors may be unhappy. And
existing employees unfortunately get wiped out.
Yeah, but you can incentivize that.
Well, I mean, they'll reprice the options. Yeah. It's really the pref that are going to get damaged by that.
It screws over the little investors.
Yeah, the little investors who are capped out, for example, and who can't put in whatever amount of money it is to protect their existing pref stack / ownership. And so, you know, like angel investors, for example, completely wiped out. But the other thing is it forces people on off the table. And so Bill Gurley, you know, he's on the board of this company, Good Eggs, and they are not participating in this cram down round. And the result is, I don't know the exact mechanism in this case, but that their ownership effectively goes to zero and that their pref stack becomes 1/10 or something of what it used instantly, which is crazy. Andy is right. It requires investors who still believe what the money just isn't there.
Well, and also probably, I don't know who led this round. A lot of VCs are as we kind of mentioned in the beginning of the show, it's very much a community. So they co-invest in all these other deals and everything. And so you're going to come in and you're going to basically be like, I'm going to come in and basically make your equity worth nothing. And even though that they are essentially saving the company because likely the other option were to go to business, it's really hard for some people that are have a close relationship with these other investors to come in and do that. And that's where I think that a lot of companies, they don't have the option to do this. But you also can make the case where if the company was in this position, it most likely wouldn't have had a venture-like outcome anyways. So that's why I think a lot of investors also don't like doing this. But yeah, Andy's had a good quote there. Yeah, it's never good to chase good money after bad, meaning like if you did make a bad investment, like you still have dollars, you should go and put it into the players that are actually doing well. I think we're in a really interesting environment now because we just have this kind of pause in a lot of like the Series A and Series B rounds with VCs just trying to wait to see what's going to happen. And it could have caught a lot of companies off guard as far as the timing of their fundraising. And then you just have, especially if you're earlier stage, like a Series A or company or Series B company likely is not going to get a cram down. It's going to be probably a later stage company, probably going to be somebody coming in that does not work that closely with Series A and Series B investors. And it's just looking for a good financial outcome. So like Good Eggs, like they're essentially like a grocery store. So I mean, I don't know who came in and did this, but like you could definitely see a non-VC type investor coming in and just wanting to kind of own a lot of this. But that's kind of like some of what's happening. But you keep on hearing there's going to be more of this. I really can't see it, honestly, on like the Series A and Series B rounds happening that much. Because it's just too hard to get done.
But, you know, it really does speak, Kevin, to this idea of like, you know, years 1 through 4 or something of a company, of a venture-backed company, are actually like the chillest
They are simplest the chillest.
Rounds and simplest years. It's just like, you know, let's make something. And then the customers are unhappy, but then all of a sudden they're happy. And
right.
They're like, oh my God, this is, I've been waiting for this for years, they say. I think it goes the right way. But like all of the incentives are aligned. Right.
Yep.
And it's just like years five, year six, year seven. Andy, I don't know how many years Nanit is in, but I know it's a meaningful number of them. It's like the structures get complicated. Inevitably, somewhere, some round is difficult, and maybe it created a structure on a financing. Now it's like, okay, so maybe the founder in year one through four is good, but like, is he still, or he or she or they still good in year seven or eight? Not really as clear. So to go the distance, it's that 10-year arc, is actually like insane. And for
that's
things
why it's
to
so
go
impressive
right,
when you see people that, especially that have went through times like this. Like if you go through a time and you have just a company that's done relatively well and you haven't had any crises like we're going through right now, and you see them going through that 10-year journey, like mm-hmm. like that's relatively easier. But like going through something like this, even if you are a good company, like it's, this is going to impact every single company.
Well, that's what that's why it impresses me so much. And I say this to you, I've always felt that maybe you have a certain risk tolerance that I don't have or something. But
for
like,
me,
yes, you,
yeah,
because you're literally like, I only raise 18 months of capital. It's like, dude, how the you don't know what's going to fucking happen in 18 months. and not only that, but you don't even, you know, like I said, and like we raised eight during that round with Andreessen and 2 million before. So we've got 10 million in ish, but like I had way more on the table. Should I have taken 10?
100%. You should have.
I didn't. I should have taken it. Right.
No.
Yes.
But like
no.
Maybe
you should have.
Right.
And,
and meanwhile, so Kevin, I'm going to express your attitude back to you. And then you can correct me.
Yes.
You're just like, fuck it. You're going to figure it out. And the pressure will cause you to operate better than you would be with that cushion. Is that right?
Totally. Yeah. That's the thing. Like when you go through times like this, like, so, and it goes, and maybe I definitely rotate a little too far to the one side, but like I was, my last company, like we went completely the other opposite direction. Like we raised on negative gross margins at like if you compare it to the money people raised 2022, that we would have been valued at like $1 billion or something like that off of like $1 million in revenue. Like that's how crazy our rounds were. And so, and then I just see like the bad behaviors that happen within companies. Like when you have a lot of money, you just mask problems with money. And when you don't have a lot of money,
agree,
it is very uncomfortable. And that may mean you have to do things like potentially do some layoffs, do some restructuring of the team. You have to say no to a lot of stuff. But it really just focuses you, and then it gives you more optionality. So you don't have this high pref stack. You don't have this huge valuation. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So in times like these, you have a little bit more optionality than the people who have raised at the 100x. And that have so much of a huge pref stack, there's just no way that they could get additional capital. And there's also no way that they could become profitable either. So they're just going to go out of business.
Yeah.
And also they haven't found product market fit because they've been using all the capital to just hire all of these senior execs. So I definitely operate in a way it's like raise the money you need to for each stage. But even during times like this, it makes it, I'm not going to lie to you, like, well, like the choices that we have to make right now, like we're in a really good position versus a lot of other companies. But like, we're not like flush with capital and never we're hiring a shitload of people and all of the things that I love to do.
Yeah.
But I think with less people relative to your stage, it creates these constraints that you use, and then you still have enough options that you are able to figure out a way at a path around everything.
Someone, some executive coach or CEO somewhere said something like, you know, the quality of the CEO is effectively their ability to make hard decisions.
Mm-hmm.
You are saying, and Andy, I feel like you've got a thought here. You're saying force herself to make those hard decisions by having no cash. I respect that. I'm not soft anymore. You know, I've got scar tissue. I respect the way that you're thinking about it. Andy,
where I was going with this is I have a mentor and someone I used to work with. He's a very successful entrepreneur. He started multiple companies, sold them for multiple $350 million plus exit. And he always drilled into me that companies go out of business for one reason. You run out of money. And basically the genesis of this advice is if you can raise money, you will figure it out and figure it as a good operator.
That is so wrong.
But no, Kevin. So
and so many different.
Apparently assumes you're a great operator.
Wait, was this Will at RRE? Will said this to me over at dinner. And maybe he got it from the thing.
He didn't.
It was like a New York
It's a West Coast individual, very well thought of. And it's true. It mostly is true. The problem is, The problem is with this and why it's not true is most people aren't good operators. And most people who were able to raise money over the past few years, just put together a PowerPoint presentation, have never run a P&L, have never looked at numbers, have never understood what it takes to make a business work. And so if you raise $15 million and treat it like, okay, we can go to the Bahamas now for a three-week team offsite, yeah, there are some perverse incentives here. But for a great operator, if you give them the right amount of capital, they're going to shine time and time again and we'll figure it out. And maybe you'll see them pivot three or four times. The problem in this advice, most people just aren't great operators. Mm-hmm. Most people are slow.
Let me ask a question. What I want to know, Andy, is inherent in your thesis, it seems like, and it seems like the venture view, maybe it'll be different later, is like, for example, like, did I need $10 million to get to where I am? I didn't use all of it, but like, did I need that to get to my next stage? No. Strictly speaking, I probably could have financed it less, but that the buffer allows for a certain amount of creativity and effectiveness should the operator be of a sufficient quality. And so it's worth financing and giving the extra cash and giving the extra valuation, which is why Second Time Founders, the name of this podcast, command the premium. Is that essentially?
Yeah, you will find product market fit. You will pivot. You will find your way into it.
I don't agree with that.
Okay. I mean, you don't have to. I've seen it happen time and time again. The problem is most of the time that people get these $50 million rounds, they're actually hype companies. And they're interesting space,
right.
Young team, and maybe they don't figure it out. Not to say that young teams are bad. I think young teams are incredible. But by definition, this is a lot of gritty work. 90% of startups fail. So we're talking about of the 10% that are successful. And I think what everyone forgot over the last couple of years and with 0% interest rates was this. There was a Redpoint study in 2012, I believe, or maybe it was 2011, where they calculated that there were only 10 deals worth doing in venture in a year. And it was your job as the venture capitalist to find one to two of those 10. Now, all of a sudden, the industry is expanded, I don't know, 50 times over.
Yes.
And so everyone is looking for a quote unquote unicorn. And I don't mean that by a $1 billion valuation company. I mean that as one of those 10 deals. And yeah, there's been some platform shifts. So maybe now there are 25 great companies a year. But that's what produces venture outcomes. And so, yes. If you give me a great operator who's made money time and time again, and they come in and they ask for $50 million, I would give it to them every day of the week.
Okay. I think that the great operator you're talking about is like one in a thousand entrepreneurs.
It's me. The great operator is me.
And the great operator is, and the reason why I just like vehemently disagree with you, and also from the VC side of things, it makes sense. Like, what can they control? They find a good operator. What can they do? The only thing they can do is give them capital. But what happens when even really good operators, when they're given a lot of capital, it allows them to think in longer time horizons. It allows them to just hire more senior people because they don't have to do the gritty shit. Like, I understand the operator you're talking about, Andy, that's willing to keep the team small and just grind it out. And like, they're talking to customers and all that. And like, do those people exist? Sure. But like, that is like 0.00001% of people who start venture-backed companies. If you could find them, sure. But also, I know a lot of other people that have created public companies that they've gone to go and create other companies and taken that $50 million and flush it down the fucking toilet. So because they have, like, the incentives just aren't totally aligned, and the time scale as well. And that's why it makes sense for, in my opinion, this is why I think you see a lot of VCs, like, what can VCs really, what do they have? They have capital, right? They have to find the right founders, and they have capital to deploy them. I think they just think that they could fix, a lot of them do. And I think their incentive is that they just can find that great operator or look for the pedigree of the team too. So I hate when I see these teams getting funded that are X Stripe and X whoever of that they had a small part in like creating their success, and they're given these like massive terms and they've never actually run a business before. But I don't know. I'm kind of rambling on, but I really do not like the idea that a great operator can always create product market fit with enough capital.
There's something that I want you to think about, Kevin, as we pass to Andy for a second. I suspect, and think it through, I suspect that there's, because your last company, it's known. It turns out I actually screenshotted the tweet where you were talking, where the account talked about ship shutting down. I remember it, right? And it was a defining moment in my life. You were my idol. Not quite, but you know. But
thank you.
Your company had a big effect on a lot of people. And so that spectacular up and down,
yeah,
had an effect on your thinking. Whereas it's when someone has been to a certain stage and they're like, fuck, if I could get another 2 million, I think we could get there, and they can't get it, that has an effect of saying, fuck, we were almost there if only we had taken a couple more million bucks. Now we're passing to Andy. He has been waiting a while. Go.
So I think at first, there's so much to unpack from what Kevin said. So first, I mean, a great operator takes a company public the first time, and we assume he's a great operator. They may not be a great operator. There's a lot of, the one thing True. About life that's very interesting, that's very hard to deduce, is luck versus skill. And so I think you Yep. can look at people who took companies public the last 5 years, people made a lot of money in venture the last 5 years. Was that a luck event or a skill event? And there's a whole thesis, and this is a whole class that in management science where we can go through and talk about luck versus skill. And there's some great books written about this. Second, pedigree a team. Pedigree a team is not equal to a great operator. Pedigree of team, why people like pedigree of team is because if the team is really good, there is a good shot, and they have pedigree, there's a good shot they'll be able to attract and hire other good people. It's not that they themselves are really good. It's just they'll know through their network, maybe they can hire great engineers they used to work with. Versus when you find someone who has no pedigree, there's a lot more hustle involved to build that team out. You have a lot, you get to skip steps. If you have a great designer that you're really close with, a great staff engineer you're really close with, and maybe a great salesperson that you're really close with, versus somebody else who's coming out of college and going to go find them on LinkedIn or through word of mouth. So that's the reason that people like pedigree. But pedigree doesn't correlate to great operating. So that's just my retort and where I come back with on this.
I agree. I completely agree with that.
So yeah. What does correlate to being a great operator?
Typically, it's proven skill.
Well, I think that's what all VCs are looking for, right? How do you actually prove, like, you could look at what somebody's done before. That could be maybe a failed startup. I think that there's a lot of great operators and entrepreneurs that are coming from failed startups, they definitely have something to prove. You can look for people that have been from zero to IPO, especially I think like in the B2B world where a lot of the kind of go-to-market and everything, those are all reproducible and you just can go and pick a market. I've seen this happen a lot before. So that's another way to go about it. But I think that's the whole thing. Like it's really unknown, like who actually is going to be a great entrepreneur and operator.
That's kind of the magic of this space a little bit.
That's the whole magic. If any three of us knew we just raised the fund, we would all be rich. So, that's kind of the name of the game.
I will say this, that just in general, I don't think that I'm just treading water here, but like there is such an advantage to just being in the venture back tech space, just because so much is going on at any given time. So you could just be treading water where other people are like in the surfing lineup. And you're just going to get picked up by something.
Right.
Right. Like, and that's just kind of amazing. It's as a result of being an executive coach to a few CEOs, I have done deals that I have been so proud of doing. And I'm looking at this business growing so quickly. Oh my God. And I've known entrepreneurs that I've met at like offsites. And the result of that is some connection to an investor 5 years down the line or some operator that I met as a result of it. It's like just being in this space. I've never seen this movie, so I'm kind of like misquoting it, but it's like plastics. You got to be in plastics because it's the future. That's the way I feel about tech. It's just like there's so much happening. Even though you might be unlucky and you might miss this one and you might miss the next one, you might miss the one after that. It's just like at some point, wave is going to hit you.
You just got to stay in the arena, right? You can't.
Yep.
You can't get out, and then eventually, you may be unlucky that there's going to be a lot of companies right now that are going to be unlucky, maybe they could have survived in the 0% interest world. I really do wonder, like, of some of the companies that even IPO, like, how many of them could have survived something like this?
Well, I mean, definitely all the Blue Aprons and all the others, right? So when you think of a number of them, these direct-to-consumer companies, surviving off of paid customer acquisition, like the Blue Aprons, all these businesses that fundamentally just didn't have network effects or just an increasing cost of acquisition with a dependence on a single channel type of thing, like money is just expensive now, so you should use it well as opposed to use it frivolously. I didn't know how to do that in the last business. Lots of businesses that were selling, not to disrespect anyone, but mattresses, you know, or whatever, like it just ain't that easy anymore.
Yeah, and I think that's where like I going through my last company has definitely taught me a lot of things. And it's like, first of all, it's like, get to product market fit as fast as you can. Like, I think that's what everybody listening here, like, once you have that, and hopefully you've done that with a pretty slim team, then that doesn't mean you're going to make it ultimately. Your options are going to be a lot higher, a lot more increased than somebody who has just chased raising larger rounds or building bigger teams. And that's something that I've done from day one here at Arrowhouse. And we potentially could have gone faster, raised more money. Maybe we could have we could have been like 10 times the size by now, but I took the learnings of like going through those hard times and trying to apply them. I think that's another thing, like, as you, Julian, you talk about us just being in venture, like, I think you need to also take all the learnings that you're going through. So, like, right now, the learnings that people should be taking from this is, like, don't be as reliant on VC as companies in the past have been. Like I look at a lot of these Walking Dead companies that are just like, they may have had a great product, but like they raised way too much money. They don't have probably product market fit, or they may not be able to raise more capital. They're not profitable. They're just probably dead. And they could have had a great team, amazing team. So I think that's like one big learning that hopefully people take out of this. Another is make sure that you understand that there's a $250,000 FDIC insurance limit on a bank account.
Right.
You properly understand how sweeps work into money market accounts and all of those different things. But I think it goes back to like what my core, like even going through this, and we have a great company. It's just like, focus on your customer, do it with as like slim as team as you can. And then I'll push back on both of you, like raise as little as you can to prove out your milestones.
It is causing me to be creative. I'll definitely say that. I believe that I would have hired more people that I probably did not need.
Right.
Part of me does want it. But that me not doing it is probably a good constraint. Andy, I was going to ask you, since I know you're closer on the venture side, like, what do you think is happening to all these scout funds and these little micro funds that these randos have? Not the ones that took off, right? The ones where they got to a meaningful amount of capital, maybe even on angel list, and let's say they make it to fund two or fund three or whatever. But what's like all these scouts, like what's happening to these people and all these like micro funds? Are they just getting wiped out and those people are going to start?
What do I think happens with those micro funds? I think they're in a lot of trouble. I think they have trouble raising fund two, fund three, fund four. I think the dirty little secret is everyone wants institutional investors. And unless you have institutional investors, if you're relying on entrepreneurs or wealthy people to kind of fill out your fund, you're going to have trouble. It's not just the micro funds. You'll see the $150 million venture funds that are going to have issues raising.
There's no doubt. Yeah.
Scout funds, I think, are a different animal. Those are focused on driving basically deal flow for the parent VC. And so I think those will exist and have no impact whatsoever. But your micro funds, everyone we know is a venture capitalist right now, right? I mean, everyone you know in the tech space has some kind of micro fund, and some will survive and some won't. And we'll see who's an actual good investor now instead of who is good at playing the hype train.
Can we end this segment? I know we're getting low on time here with like everybody's learnings that they've taken going through this, call it, I don't know, the last like kind of interest rates going up and SVB collapsing.
Yeah, it's a good way to end the episode. But I will say this is, the last time that I ran a business in the seed and a type of stage, there was this assumption of, oh, we can hire to solve, right? Mm-hmm. I definitely thought that. I remember thinking that. And I was not good at saying no. And I gave people that were actually inexperienced operators at the time the benefit of doubt. Oh, you say you need to hire someone? Sure. Like, fuck it.
Right.
I am a little bit, I'm meaningfully more Dr. No today, right?
Right.
One is I have more experience than some of the people that I work with, but way more experience than I did last time. But that's an element of it, is become Dr. No faster. And I think that you end up being able to get better operation of your business out of it. Don't force yourself to hire the five more people because other people wanted you to,
right,
and then cut down. Right? Always keep as tight as you can. So that is certainly one of the biggest lessons. I'm extremely happy that I have a tight burn relative to what other companies I know have.
Right. Right. Andy, what do you...
I'll take this one. So I think last 5-8 years were kind of a reinvention of the laws of gravity. And when I started my career at Lehman, we learned some very interesting lessons in 2008 when we went bankrupt. When I did venture in 2009 to 2011, learned a lot of interesting lessons. And for me, these were always negative lessons that we were able to learn. And 2014 to maybe 2017 to 2021 was the exact opposite lesson. And I think the reality is we've just reverted to the mean, and everything reverts to the mean. And that's where we are today. We may have overcorrected a bit, but it is mean reversion. Yeah. And that's all it really is. And yeah, we'll normalize somewhere in a year or two. But right now we've overcorrected. And this is the basis for the efficient market hypothesis. Our market's perfectly efficient. And I would argue no.
So Kevin, what about you?
I'd say that doing better scenario planning. So I had a lot of other people that predicted a lot of what's happening today. And I think that we did a fairly good job of navigating it. But I think looking back at it, I could have done some upfront scenario planning. If this happens, then go and do this, and then really pull the trigger on it versus being more reactive. And so that's what I'm going and also just listening to, and not just thinking that all of these people are just crazy and these things will never happen, because no, that the economy is just fine and everything. Really look at there was certain markers, and there were certain smart people either on Twitter or even my friends were like, you got to be careful here. Like, shit's maybe not going to go so well. And for me, kind of my learning from my last company set us up, and I think in a much better position. But I think that scenario planning even more so, and maybe listening to some of those folks and taking it even more cautious, I think that we could have been in a bit better position. But I'm still happy where we are today, especially versus other companies. But it's going to be tough to get out of that, all these companies to get out of this. And there's going to be so many people. And I hope the good companies stick around, but some of them may be mismanaged and they won't. And that's going to be terrible. But I think, yeah, I definitely would. I don't know. Are you guys big on scenario planning? Are you guys big on scenario planning?
Are we doing scenario planning? There's not a lot of scenarios in where I'm at, right? It's definitely, we do have a growth model, and we do look at the business and say, where do we believe we're going to get to, and what time frame, and what the results of that are. One of my investors recently asked me, do you have product market fit? I was like, yes, I believe that I do. But without a really clear distribution channel. So to me, it's, there's a linear path and there's sort of an upward path, but there's not much of a, it's funny to say about it, not much of a slower than this path, right? I think the business doesn't quite yet need it.
Right.
But in a year, I could see how scenario planning would have been really helpful. I couldn't have tighter of a team than this either, I think. I think it would be really tough to do that.
Right. Well, let's end it here.
Yeah, do you guys too? Okay, let's end it. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Great chatting. Bye-bye.
See everybody later. Bye. Hey, yeah, we keep it real and we bring you the facts. It's the Second Time Founders Podcast. Talking tech news, the show is a must. Not some billionaire trying to sell you their book. We're coming from a real place, plenty ups and downs. Got some insights, join the discussion now. We being honest and raw, giving you real talk. We've been at the bottom and made it happen and much more. The Second Time Founders Podcast. More building, less talk.